Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Shelby County, Alabama, 1908. 40 convicts, poor, black, and arrested on specious charges, were essentially sold by the local sheriff to the U.S. Steel Corporation, shackled, sent deep into the earth to dig coal 8 tons a day, 6 days a week, or be whipped. Decades after the Emancipation Proclamation, they were chained, beaten, starved, in every way that mattered, enslaved. In the wake of Reconstruction, a new reign of terror began for African Americans across the Deep South and would continue for thousands and thousands until the Second World War. This hour, On Point, a new history of slavery by another name. You can join the conversation. Do you really know what went on with African Americans after the Civil War? Did you know that for nearly 80 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, right up to the Second World War, thousands of African Americans lived, worked, and died in chains? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia, is Douglas Blackman, winner of the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for his explosive book of historical investigation, Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. He is Atlanta bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal and a son of the Mississippi Delta. Doug Blackman, it's good to have you with us. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I know this book came out a year ago. It's in the spotlight again now because of your Pulitzer Prize, and congratulations. I'm so glad it won the prize and brought it to our attention. It is absolutely mind-blowing what you've found here. I guess we're right in calling it investigative history. This is very real history that 100,000, maybe twice that, lived in. But how many Americans really knew what was going on here, Doug? This was well hidden, but why?
Investigative history is a good term, by the way. I think I'm going to steal that. This was something that, at the time it was happening, shockingly perhaps by our contemporary sensibilities, this was something that, in fact, thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans knew about when it was happening. Certainly in the South, to some degree in the North, this was woven into the fabric of life in the rural South in the decades after the Civil War and deep into the 20th century. And it involved hundreds of thousands, ultimately, of African Americans, and was something that almost all white Southerners were aware of to some degree and were untroubled by. And frankly, most whites across the country by that stage of our history had given up on the idea of the full integration of African Americans into American life.
Martin Luther King scribbled a note that's become part of history at one point in his long civil rights struggle. He wrote, "The South deluded itself with the illusion that the Negro was happy in his place. The North deluded itself with the illusion that it had freed the Negro." We're going to get the details here, and they're shocking, they're brutal, and the volume is just incredible. But I wish you could just describe for us sort of the myth versus the fact here. What were the myths that the country lived in after the Civil War in all those decades versus the broad outline of facts that you've uncovered?
The myth was certainly among white Americans. The myth in modern times has been the thing that you probably were taught or absorbed, certainly what I was taught and absorbed growing up over the last 40 years, was that the Civil War ended slavery, freed the slaves from their white masters, and then what followed was a long, difficult time in which African Americans were inconvenienced and mistreated and called a bad name and deprived of the vote, and during which time they did not move forward or advance economically or in terms of educational achievement in comparison to whites, and that then finally Martin Luther King came along in the 1950s and the 60s, and defeated the Ku Klux Klan and ended all of that. And now we have the society that we live in. Mm. That's the basic mythology of race in America that most of us ascribe to or did ascribe to. The reality is that that slavery really ended only briefly. Slavery was interrupted for a period of 20 or 30 years, depending on where you're talking about in the Deep South. But by the 1880s and the 1890s, a tremendous national and regional conversation battle was playing out over what the role of freed slaves and their descendants would be in American life. And by the time we reached the 1890s, a de facto kind of slavery in various mechanisms and various forms has reinstituted itself, has been resurrected by white Southerners. White Northerners have, for the most part, given up on the idea of citizenship for African Americans and don't want to fight about it anymore and leave the fate of black men and women to white Southerners. And by the time we get to the first years of the 20th century, this whole terroristic cancer on American life has metastasized across the South. Black life has become brutally circumscribed. Citizenship has been withdrawn from millions of African Americans effectively, and that situation does not change, and it is enforced brutally and constantly for the next four decades, leading right up to the beginning of World War II.
And done through a legal system in the South that was turned over to a kind of creating a kind of slave camp, much more literally than I have to say I really ever understood. I wish you'd read just from the top of the book. It's a little bit long here, but there's the case of Green Cottenham, one man. You write about his family, but one man caught in this system. I think this reading will give us a sense of what you're onto, Douglas Blackman.
On March 30th, 1908, Green Cottenham was arrested by the sheriff of Shelby County, Alabama, and charged with vagrancy. Cottenham had committed no true crime. Vagrancy, the offense of a person not being able to prove at a given moment that he or she is employed, was a new and flimsy concoction, dredged up from legal obscurity at the end of the 19th century by the state legislatures of Alabama and every other southern state. It was capriciously enforced by local sheriffs and constables, adjudicated by mayors and notaries public, recorded haphazardly or not at all in court records, and most tellingly, in a time of massive unemployment among all Southern men, was reserved almost exclusively for black men. Cottenham's true offense was blackness. After 3 days behind bars, the 22-year-old man was found guilty in a swift appearance before the county judge and immediately sentenced to a 30-day term of hard labor. Unable to pay the array of fees assessed on every prisoner, fees to the sheriff, the deputy, the court clerk, the witnesses, Cottenham's sentence was extended to nearly a year of hard labor. The next day, Cottenham, the youngest of nine children, born to former slaves in an adjoining county, was sold. Under a standing arrangement between the county and a vast subsidiary of the industrial titan of the North, U.S. Steel Corporation, the sheriff turned the young man over to the company for the duration of his sentence. In return, the subsidiary, Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, gave the county $12 a month to pay off Cottenham's fine and fees. What the company's managers did with Cottenham and thousands of other black men they purchased from sheriffs across Alabama was entirely up to them. A few hours later, the company plunged Cottenham into the darkness of a mine called Slope No. 12, one shaft in a vast subterranean labyrinth on the edge of Birmingham known as the Pratt Mines. There he was chained inside a long wooden barrack at night and required to spend nearly every waking hour digging and loading coal. His required daily task was to remove 8 tons of coal from the mine. Cottenham was subject to the whip for failure to dig the requisite amount, at risk of physical torture for disobedience, and vulnerable to the sexual predations of other miners, many of whom already had passed years or decades in their own Chthonian confinement. The lightless catacombs of black rock, packed with hundreds of desperate men slick with sweat and coated in pulverized coal, must have exceeded any vision of hell a boy born in the countryside of Alabama, even a child of slaves, could have ever imagined. Waves of disease ripped through the population. In the month before Cottenham arrived at the prison mine, pneumonia and tuberculosis sickened dozens. Within his first 4 weeks, 6 died. Before the year was over, almost 60 men forced into Slope 12 were dead of disease, accidents, or homicide. Most of the broken bodies, along with hundreds of others before and after, were dumped into shallow graves scattered among the refuse of the mine. Others were incinerated in nearby ovens used to blast millions of tons of coal brought to the surface into coke, the carbon-rich fuel essential to U.S. Steel's production of iron. 45 years after President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation freeing American slaves, Green Cottenham and more than 1,000 other black men toiled under the lash at Slope 12, imprisoned in what was then the most advanced city of the South, guarded by whipping bosses employed by the most iconic example of the modern corporation emerging in the gilded North. There were slaves in all but name.
Slaves in all but name, Douglas Blackman reading from his Pulitzer Prize-winning history, Slavery by Another Name, the Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. You go on to follow Green Cottenham and the Cottenham family in the fates of millions, thousands and thousands of other African Americans after the Civil War. And this is history that, the chain gang image, the photograph is kind of iconic. All Americans know it. But this paints really a different picture, not just prisoners out, cleaning up the roadside. This is, as you say, slavery in all but name.
Well, astonishingly, our images that we have of chain gangs, most of which we take from pop culture, mm-hmm. like Cool Hand Luke and more recent films like Brother, Where Art Thou, mm-hmm. That's mostly where we have a picture of the chain gang. And in modern times, we've remembered the chain gang as a terrible affront, a sort of scandalous thing. The reality was that those chain gang depictions from the 1940s and 50s were actually the reforms of the system that I write about in the book. What was here was vastly, vastly worse than anything we're familiar with in terms of chain gangs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about decades of near slavery in America after the Civil War with writer Douglas Blackman, whose work on this astounding history just won him the Pulitzer Prize. His book is Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. And I should say, at our website, onpointradio.org, you can link to a quite incredible photo gallery that Douglas Blackman has put together for the book. I'm looking here. This is published in 1932. Unnamed prisoner in a labor camp in Georgia, wrapped around a pickaxe, chained around a pickaxe in a quite unbelievable way. Cage cars of black men being transported around the South, what looks like slave quarters, as you say, in every way but name. What pretty much torture punishment going on here in a labor camp. Douglas Blackman, I wish you'd give us a sense of the system, the settings, the scale of what you describe in the book.
This was a system which grew out of a series of experiments that really began before the Civil War, when a handful of Southern industrialists in the 1850s began to challenge what had been the prevailing view of slavery before the Civil War. And that prevailing view was that blacks really were only competent to work as agricultural laborers for the most part. And there was this presumption that somehow Africans could not be employed in industrial settings. But during the 1850s, there began to be a small group of white male capitalists, mostly in Alabama, Georgia, some in Virginia, who began to use slaves in coal mines and factory settings and sawmills. And what they discovered was that, of course, it was incredibly lucrative. And it also allowed for a much faster return on their investments in slaves, which also meant that it mattered less that slaves live a long life. That whole evolution toward industrial slavery was interrupted by the Civil War. But after the war, the same group of men, in many cases, set out to resurrect that form of slavery, and that happened to intersect conveniently and very profitably with the South's desire to end the political and civic lives of all African Americans across the South. And so this new kind of involuntary servitude, which was constructed around a great perversion of the criminal justice system, became one of the primary instruments of forcing African Americans out of the political life of the South and intimidating them into these subservient roles that we're familiar with in terms of sharecroppers and the general poverty of African Americans.
Describe for us how the criminal justice system was put into service of this system.
The way this would work was that all across the South, particularly in rural areas, law enforcement officers received no meaningful compensation. So the sheriff of a county deep in South Alabama received no pay for being sheriff. But how he was compensated was that he was allowed by statute to charge a fee to every prisoner that he arrested, and a fee for a whole range of other acts that he might undertake in his official capacities. He was also paid a small amount of money to feed the prisoners in his jail, and he got a set amount from the state for every day that a prisoner was in the jail, but then he could keep whatever was left over after he had actually fed the prisoners in his jail. And so this created an economic incentive to sheriffs to arrest as many people as possible and to feed them as little as possible. Now, at the same time this was happening, this all over the South, this practice developed of that impoverished African Americans, when they were arrested on these misdemeanor charges like vagrancy and a whole host of other laws that were passed primarily to criminalize black life, to make it difficult for African Americans to avoid legal infractions at any given time, they also were almost always unable to pay these enormous fees and fines, which would be levied on them as a result of their arrests. And so the practice developed that after a man like Green Cottonham was arrested on some specious charge, oftentimes invented and as part of a roundup of many young African-American men, unable to pay their fines, they would effectively be sold to some commercial interest, like a coal mine or a timber camp, in some cases a plantation somewhere to do agricultural work, a whole range of these kinds of brute manual labor industries. The commercial interest would pay the fines off over a period of 1 to 5 years, and the sheriff would be remunerated handsomely as a result of that, would have also made money off of starving the prisoners while they were in his jail, and then the commercial interest would be able to do whatever they wanted to under almost no regulatory protections or oversight as long as they held these men.
I want to get to the scale of this and the industrial significance and legacy, but when people hear you say that black life was criminalized, that these were specious charges, that goes up against what you write was a kind of sense that came out of this time that after the Civil War, African Americans couldn't handle freedom, that there was a crime wave in the South, that it was necessary to sort of get tough, to hold things together. You put it in quite different terms. We should get more specific about the kind of charges that were levied here, about how people were brought into this system of effective slavery, as you call it.
Well, there's another mythology that most of us at some level have been affected with, was this idea that somehow that at the end of the Civil War, you had these 4 million former slaves suddenly freed, and that we tend to perceive them, and certainly whites have wanted to perceive them oftentimes, the same way that we talked about the residents of former communist states as the Berlin Wall was falling, the Iron Curtain was falling, this idea that people who'd lived under a repression for all these years were sort of unable to handle the freedom of a truly free and democratic society. Well, there was a similar idea about freed slaves, and there was this story that developed that said that African Americans went on a kind of rampage of petty criminality, thievery, and all sorts of misconduct all across the South. Well, I as I pursued this and investigated and did the research for the book, I felt strongly that if that were the case, it had to be the case that somewhere there would be substantial evidence of these criminal acts, that there would be voluminous files in a courthouse somewhere showing how these waves of criminality had occurred. And so I went back looking for all of that. And what I found after visiting courthouse after courthouse after courthouse and identifying all sorts of repositories of 100-year-old records was that in reality these crime waves never happened. There was chaos in the South after the Civil War, but it was mostly whites playing out grudges and grievances from during the Civil War period against other whites. And the truth was that in most places in the South, there was almost no criminal activity, almost no arrests, except at a time when one of these large industrial interests or commercial interests needed labor. And when that was the case, local sheriffs would begin these aggressive roundups in which 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 men at a time would be essentially seized in a very short period, all charged with misdemeanor offenses such as vagrancy, speaking loudly in the company of white women, walking beside a railroad, selling their cotton or some other farm produce after dark, carrying a concealed weapon. The first gun control laws were actually passed in the South specifically to disarm black men. Mm. A whole range of these offenses, of these statutes, which had been passed by the Southern legislatures primarily to criminalize black life and make it possible for sheriffs and then eventually just thugs who would work the back roads of the South seizing men for no reason at all, but to create a basis for these kangaroo convictions after which they could be sold into these commercial interests.
And when you, as a reporter, a journalist, when you write about the re-enslavement of black Americans, you're not speaking or writing metaphorically. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of forced labor camps. You're talking about maybe hundreds of thousands of people. You're talking about really a wide system here. And labor camps all across the South at that time, you write that these bulging slave centers, you call them, became a primary weapon of suppression of black aspirations, more effective than Ku Klux Klan terror or anything else.
These forced labor camps, which labor camp is almost a misnomer, these were places that much more so resembled a German death camp during World War II than one might think of as a work camp, mm-hmm. a labor camp. These were and they were everywhere. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. Georgia and Alabama were really the epicenter of these practices, but they occurred all over the South. In Georgia alone, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were dozens of these forced labor camps all over the state, thousands and thousands of men, probably 10 or 15,000 individuals at any given time were being held in the camps. In Alabama, over the span of 30 or 40 years, I can precisely document up to about 200,000 individuals having passed through those camps. The number is probably much, much larger. Certainly, all over the South, in toto, over the span of the 50 or 60 years when this was at its height, many hundreds of thousands of individuals were directly impacted by this. But in addition to that, the threat of being forced back into this this kind of slavery, which in some respects was far more dangerous, far more terrifying than the slavery that had preceded the Civil War, and the threat of being forced back into that was a hammer hanging over the head of every African-American man anywhere in the rural South. And it was this threat that was a part, a grinding element of daily life, and that forced millions of African-Americans to go along with these other repressive racial measures which dramatically circumscribed their lives. And it was also no coincidence that again and again and again, when African-American leaders would emerge, particularly in the 1880s and 1890s, when there was still a real battle over whether African-Americans would have a political life and a civic life, again and again, the men who emerged as important leaders who could rally African-Americans or inspire whites to be on their side found themselves charged with these specious offenses and forced back into these hell holes from which many of them never returned.
Hell hole, really the right word, as you describe these mines and other settings, just incredible. And, of course, they knew what was going on all too vividly. This was decades after the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation, but there wasn't much of anywhere to turn. You quote from a letter here, July 31st, 1903, to President Teddy Roosevelt, came to the White House from Carrie Kinsey, just barely literate African-American woman in Bainbridge, Georgia, and her 14-year-old brother, as she describes, James Robinson, had been abducted, had been sold to a plantation. Local police would not take any interest, and she wrote, "Mr. President, they won't let me have him. He has not done nothing for them to have him in chains, so I write to you for your help." That help never came. Rick, in Newmarket, Virginia, you are on the air with Douglas Blackman. Thanks very much for calling. You're on the air, Rick.
Hi. I became aware of the slavery that followed the abolition and the Emancipation Proclamation about 3 years ago when working in Middleburg, Virginia. There's an old black gentleman there, about 85 years old, who's still suffering from that particular institution. He was raised on a farm just outside of Front Royal, and he describes to me, he's still alive, he and his wife, and he describes to me a situation where they were, all the children of his family lived in a attic on a farm, and they all had to work for the farmer, and they were never paid in money. He at one point received 10 cents a day, but his father and his family were paid with a bag of wheat or a bag of flour or half a beef, and he never had any wages. And he always tells me, he laughs and says, "Lord, we could never get off that farm. I just couldn't get off that farm." Mm. So they were actually enslaved and trapped there. And he still suffers today. There are people who still suffer today from this because his Social Security is based on actual income, taxed income, and he never had any. He always worked for housing and for food, and so now he gets an absolute minimum of Social Security, and he still suffers. And I do a lot of work for him free, and the community kind of helps him, but he shouldn't have to live like that.
Rick, thank you for your call. We'll talk about the economic ramifications of this going forward from that time, but here's a man who felt or was trapped on a farm, and his story. Give us a sense of the range of settings in which this effective neo-slavery, you call it, played out, and the treatment of those who were there, Douglas.
Well, Tom, the caller's story is exactly on point. And, in fact, over the past year, I've done appearances and talked to groups all over the country, and everywhere I go, every time I talk about the book, if there are any African Americans in the audience, at the end of the session or during the Q&A, someone stands, oftentimes many people will stand, and say, "I finally understand the story that my grandfather used to tell or that my great-grandmother used to tell before she died." And the truth is that people like the man that the caller just described, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of African Americans who are alive today but who were born in the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s into a state of de facto slavery. And there are thousands of black families that have accounts like that, that if someone was listening to the elder of the family before they died or if that person is still around, that these mysterious stories which people mistakenly believed to be exceptions and that this was something that had happened uniquely to their family or to a small number of people. But the reality was hundreds of thousands, millions really, of African Americans who were born in the 1930s, 1920s, lived in places where they couldn't leave the farm. Hundreds of thousands did escape, and we know about that too, and that's another element of that time. But the reality remains that enormous numbers of people simply could not escape the circumstances like the man who was just described. And so many families have these stories of not being able to leave the farm of a white person or the forced employment of some white person until a brother came back from service in World War II and snuck them away in the middle of the night, or any number of other circumstances where finally they achieved some sort of freedom at the end of World War II, or even later in some cases.
And yet we think about the great migration of African Americans out of the South as having come later, really after World War II. If it was this bad and this widely known and this huge a threat to life and limb, why didn't African Americans just flee the Deep South en masse during that nearly century?
Well, they did. I mean, and this is the reason why the Great Migration began. Now, in the conventional telling of 20th century American history, there is a tendency among historians to specifically identify lynchings and a kind of lower grade sort of racial animosity as being the precipitant factors for why large numbers of African Americans began to leave the South. But the reality was there was this much, much more intense, much, much more terrifying thing happening in the Deep South. That was the motivating factor for triggering the movement of African Americans out. But there were also huge numbers of blacks who simply couldn't, who attempted to but could not, in part because families like the one that was just described by your caller were ones for whom buying a train ticket to Chicago actually was not an option because the circumstances they were in was so terrifying. The photograph you described earlier in the show about the man, the young black man, chained to a pickaxe in a work camp in Georgia in 1932.
Tightly bound around it. Talk about torture. This is it.
Absolutely. And these men were subjected, and a small number of women, but overwhelmingly men, were subjected to tortures unimaginable to us, except when we hear about some of the tortures inflicted on prisoners in Iraq, like waterboarding and some of the others.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about decades of near slavery in America after the Civil War with writer Douglas Blackman, whose work on this really incredible history just won him the Pulitzer Prize for the book Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II, nearly 80 years. Douglas Blackman is bureau chief in Atlanta, Georgia, for the Wall Street Journal, and a son of the South himself, grew up in the Mississippi Delta. Douglas, I'm still mindful of the power of those images out of Hollywood, some in photographs of the chain gang, which you remind us is really 40s and 1950s. And we should make the distinction very clear of how what you're talking about is different from those images people have in, you know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, or some Paul Newman movie. The difference between that and the reality your research unearthed.
The most obvious difference between those depictions of the chain gang and what was happening in the decades before that was that in almost all of the artistic and entertainment depictions of chain gangs or prison labor camps, the depictions show a lot of white people there, and you know usually
on the gang
happened,
also mm-hmm.
on the gang also, and the reality was that these were practices which were perpetrated overwhelmingly against African Americans. There were small numbers of whites who came into these, who were victims of these same practices, but overwhelmingly, in terms of 80%, 90% or more, this was something that was done to black people. But in addition to that, before the chain gang came along, the chain gang was a reform, actually, in response to some of the brutalizations and horrifying deaths that had occurred. Typically, what would cause a scandal would be if a white person were sucked into the system, and then a white person was so brutalized that they died or they were murdered by a guard in one of the labor camps. This would cause some public outrage, and as a result of that, beginning in the 1920s, there started to be some movement toward using laborers, instead of selling them to commercial interests, using them to improve the roads of the South, and so that got them out into the open where they were chained together and worked on chain gangs. That's the origins of all that. But what preceded it was something in which you had free individuals seized by sheriffs or simply by private citizens who were in the business of seizing African Americans. They were then sold, money changed hands, oftentimes outside the purview of the court system or in fraudulent court actions. They were sold and resold. In Atlanta, there was a great brick factory on the outskirts of the city where hundreds of millions of bricks were made to pave the streets of the city and the sidewalks. The bricks are in my house, my 100-year-old house in downtown Atlanta. These bricks were everywhere, purchased by the city of Atlanta. They were all made by slave laborers at this one brick factory. And in 1905, 1906, any person could go out to the Chattahoochee Brick Company on a Sunday afternoon, and there was a slave sale. And you could bring a black man with you and trade him for another black worker. Men were paraded out and inspected like horses, their teeth examined, their soles of their feet looked at by buyers. There was bargaining over their price. This was slavery, the buying and selling of human beings.
And what years are we talking about there?
That's 1905, 1906.
1905. And I guess the other thing that struck me, put up against the images people have, was just how horrific the circumstances of many of these forced labor scenes were, both the work itself and the ramifications if people tried to resist the forced labor that they were put into.
Well, a very important thing to remember, and this is not in any way to suggest that antebellum slavery, the kind of slavery we're more familiar with, that it was not horrifying and terrible in every regard. But at least in the form of slavery that existed before the Civil War, there was an economic incentive to slave owners to keep slaves alive. They wanted slaves to live a long time. They wanted them to have some semblance of family life and to procreate so that there would be more slaves. And slaves were extremely expensive. And so white slave owners in the South before the Civil War had no reason to so brutalize their slaves that they would prematurely die. Well, this new system of slavery was very different. Slaves typically did not spend their entire lives working as forced laborers. They were incredibly cheap to obtain. They were overwhelmingly men young men who the owners, so to speak, did not want distracted by women and family life. And so what that meant was these men were worked to the absolute limits of human capacity. And as long as the cost of their acquisition was repaid within 6 months or a year, then whatever money was made working them after that was gravy to the men who controlled them, and so frequently they were worked to death.
You grew up in the Mississippi Delta. You're a son of the South. You've done the research. What did Southerners think was going on here How was this justified or rationalized in their minds at the time?
Southern whites believed, and to a somewhat lesser degree, but probably not significantly lesser degree, whites everywhere in the country believed at the beginning of the 20th century that, number one, it had been folly to try to grant citizenship to African Americans. Even Ulysses Grant, during the time he was president, said to members of his cabinet that it had been a mistake to give the vote and to give citizenship to African Americans, that it had been the right thing to end slavery, but the wrong thing to try to make blacks citizens of the country. That was an overwhelmingly adhered to view all across America at the beginning of the 20th century. There was also a view that impoverishment and subservience and subjugation was the natural condition of the descendants of African slaves. And so white Southerners knew all of this was happening. They at times were appalled when the violence and brutality would reach what were perceived as unacceptable levels. When the mortality in a work camp would exceed 30% or 40% in 1 year, there would be mild protest and some insistence on moderation. But for the most part, white Americans accepted that the general state of subservience and brutalization of African Americans that was happening in that period of time was an appropriate way for our society to have African Americans as not citizens but residents.
We've kept a lot of callers waiting to join you, Herbert, in Sardis, Georgia. You're on the air, Herbert.
Yes, how you doing, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you know, sir?
My father was born in 1929, and he used to always tell me stories about his life. He had 11 brothers and lived in that same town, and every one of them was lynched except for one. His father was a Baptist minister, and they didn't want him to know how to read, and I guess they had too much pride. But basically, they had to flee to New York City to live decades and then come back to visit. I can remember him saying he drove down in a Cadillac that he bought in New York, and he had to pretend he was a chauffeur for the governor or the mayor because they would try to lynch him if he thought it was his car.
Lynching is a terrible short path to death. What about this kind of story of forced labor? Have any of those come down in your family telling, Herbert?
Yes, my grandfather was a sharecropper, and from what I gathered, all the land he owned, all that was, he was forced to do it and get paid little or nothing for it. It's a lot of history in it.
Yes, there is. Thank you very much for your call. And let me get another from Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. And yes, I know about this because I listen to shows like the Diane Rehm Show, On Point, Fresh Air, and Talk of the Nation, and a lot of the History Channel. Several of the points that the gentleman brought out were covered in a very cartoonish segment of Michael Moore's movie, Bowling for Columbine, which I watched last night, and I was surprised that some of those things were talked about today. But this is the point that I called in. This past primary, this country had an opportunity to have an open, frank discussion about slavery when Reverend Wright was brought into the picture, a follower and believer of black liberation theology. Slavery in America is whitewashed. It's not taught in its entirety in the history books, so white America knows very little about it. But if they remember the George Allen Makaka moment, he spoke briefly of, quote, the real South, end quote. And one other point, and I forgot what it was. But
Jay, I think you put a lot on the table with Reverend Wright right there. Let me take it to Douglas Blackman. Doug, Jay says, look, this is you want to know the source of anger? Too many people are trapped in kind of myths and unknowing about that era. Makes Reverend Wright more understandable when you hear the kind of history you're writing. How do you respond to that, Douglas?
There's no doubt that that regardless of what I or anyone else thinks specifically about the words that Reverend Wright used or particularly the second episode of Reverend Wright versus the first episode, or the details don't really matter very much. But what is certainly true, and I think no one who reads my book could come away without some greater appreciation for the source of the anger that percolates up still through someone like Reverend Wright. And that is there is a very legitimate foundation for that anger, particularly in in the degree to which we have never fully confronted the enormity of the things that were done to African Americans.
You also write in the book that the reactions of many African American readers struck you, them describing your telling of this history as lifting a burden, a terrible burden for them, because it began to answer the question of what happened to these sort of lost decades after the Civil War, where African Americans seemed to just be going nowhere for so long. They got some kind of answer from you as to what was happening there.
That's been a powerful experience for me over the past year, to witness that happen again and again and again, because what it boils down to is that the basic story of why there remains such a striking divide between blacks and whites in America in terms of economic achievement and educational attainment and all those other measures, the basic explanation that we've always been given for that was that somehow the poverty and lack of education of slaves back in 1865 somehow explained why African Americans remain poorer and less educated today. Well, that just doesn't make any sense. The idea that 150 years later that would explain the social conditions, no one would make that argument about whites.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. A lot happens. And so for many African Americans, particularly aspiring younger people who not sort of drenched in as much of the sense of racial crimes of the past, were perplexed by this. The idea that somehow poverty 150 years ago and the Ku Klux Klan explained everything just didn't make sense. And so they knew in their hearts there had to be, and in their heads, that there had to be some other explanation. And one thing I've discovered is that this book, because it is methodical, it is unbiased, it is dispassionate in some regards, but it acknowledges the outrageousness of these crimes. Because it's written by a white Southerner who works for Rupert Murdoch at the Wall Street Journal, the most conservative newspaper in America, for all these reasons, it's very difficult to be dismissive of this very empirical treatment that demonstrates that the reality is slavery didn't end 150 years ago. It began to end 50 years ago, and that is the primary explanation for the continuing divide between blacks and whites. And one last point I'll make on that is that once African Americans were truly liberated to participate in the economic opportunities of American society, which is probably around 1970, let's say, that that's effectively true, since that time, the achievements of African Americans in terms of wealth gains and educational gains have been so great that I would argue they are unparalleled in human history.
You ask us to look at this in a new way. You began to do that yourself as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. You write that the question on your mind was, what would be revealed if American corporations were examined through the same sharp lens of historical confrontation as the one then being trained on German corporations that had relied on Jewish slave labor during World War II, on Swiss bankers that had robbed victims of the Holocaust of their fortunes? Is that what you've done here? Does that remain to be done? These are not unknown corporations that were many involved in this or have legacy threads going back to this. Have Americans ever looked at it in those terms?
In reality, no. In no comprehensive way. And I believe that we absolutely must. Not to cast aspersions at companies that exist today. The U.S. Steel Corporation of today, the Coca-Cola Corporation of today, many others that in one way or another thread back, many major banks, every major railroad in America, all of these modern corporations, which in one way or another rest on this legacy or on fortunes derived from these practices. I don't say that we should resurrect this in order to tar them somehow, because in reality, they and the individuals who run those companies today knew nothing of this, had nothing to do with this, and I would argue we cannot say that this means anything specific to them. But these are things which, just like African Americans, need to be able to understand the truth of why things are the way they are today. All of us must also understand the truth of our economic structures, the reality of what happened in the past. And one thing we have never done as a society is to examine commercial activity and corporate conduct as it related to the Jim Crow era and to all of these kinds of practices. And one other point I would make on that that's very important to me is that This book is not a story of black history. It is not a story of white evils. It is a story of American history. It is the reality of what Americans did to Americans in this period of time and in ways which still sculpt the lives and the world that we live in today. And if we want to have a shared understanding, a shared consensus about the future as Americans, we have to be brutally honest about our past as Americans.
We have so many callers I can't get to here. Some saying, look, our prisons are still full of African-American men. We need to look at that. Azola in Buffalo, New York, saying her preacher was just preaching about this, your book, on Sunday, but saying it's also time for forgiveness now. What about that message? We've just got half a minute here, Douglas. But how do you see it? Time to dig further, illuminate more, forgive? How do you
look at those? All of those things, and the one thing that I have seen again and again, and I don't have a five-point plan for solving all of America's racial issues or bridging the racial divide, but I will say what I have discovered in the writing of this book, in talking about it in all of my life, really, is that honesty, candor, dialogue, undefensive discussion about the truth of the past and the truth of where we stand today, those are the ways to find forgiveness or to find a path forward.
Douglas Blackman, I'm so glad you've been acknowledged for this work with the Pulitzer Prize. It's really important history and an unbelievable amount of digging yourself to bring it to us. We're grateful to you for being with us from Atlanta today, and thank you so much for the work in the book.
Thank you, Tom.
Douglas Blackman, Atlanta Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal and author of Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. It is astonishing history. I encourage you to read it if you have the chance. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.